Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 30th of November, as we record. After a week in which the investment industry was lessened by the death of Berkshire Hathaway Vice Chair Charlie Munger, one of his many famous phrases to live by was, "Avoiding stupidity is easier than seeking brilliance," so we will attempt to conform to that at least on today's show. On which note, on the show today, we are going to be looking at interim results from a high flyer, pensions consultancy XPS. And prior to that, the full year figures from a former high flyer, music equipment manufacturer Focusrite, both of which were released in recent days. We're also going to be discussing our cover feature this week, which, appropriately enough, given the plummeting temperatures all around us, is on energy security. Joining me to discuss all of this are, over the line, Julian Hoffman.
Hello, Dan.
And Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan.
And in the studio, James Norrington.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, everyone. We're going to start then with the AIM-listed Focusrite. It makes and distributes music recording equipment. I dare say some of the material in this studio has probably come from them at some point. And the same goes for live music equipment as well. It's been on quite a roller coaster ride share price-wise over the past couple of years. Alex, what did you make of the figures themselves, first of all?
Well, it was in some ways optically a repeat of last year. So, I mean, the real headline here is the top line. So revenue for the year at the end of August dipped 3%, but organic sales were down in the previous financial year as well. So momentum has basically evaporated from this business at a group level. And in the content creation division, which has, you know, historically been the big driver of the business and kind of what it's known for. So this is sort of your home studio hardware and software if you're into making music at home or streaming or whatever, and makes about three quarters of sales, has kind of gone into reverse. So, you know, a bit more context for you know, perhaps listeners who aren't too familiar with Focusrite. I mean, it was a great growth stock prior to the pandemic because it had a very sort of very strong defined product space. It was tapping into a big growth trend, but really when the pandemic hit, like lots of other sectors, it went into kind of hypersonic growth mode. So I mean, in the 2 years to August 2021, sales doubled and operating profit tripled. So as you say, yeah, it's been an absolute roller coaster for investors and kind of a bitter pill to swallow to see 2 years of essentially kind of stagnation at the income statement level. The other bitter pill to swallow really is that as well as sales falling, we first had cost of sales and now administrative expenses ticking up. So that has hit profits and eroded margins. But yeah, we can come on to maybe some of the brighter spots maybe as well.
The thing that I find very strange about the company is why anyone thought that, you know, it's an area that seems that attracts any kind of value, because, you know, surely digital recording equipment is a very commoditized space anyways. I mean, you know, my mother only bought Sony hi-fis because that was what was good in the 1970s. But I mean, you see my point. I mean, it doesn't appear to have any pricing power, does it? I mean, as Martha pointed out.
Alex, your thoughts on pricing power before I jump into some other points?
I mean, yeah, I would disagree. I would actually disagree. I mean, I think you can say there are elements of any hardware, particular, you know, if it's low ticket item hardware, that it can end up commoditized. The niche that Focusrite is in and the quality product line it has, I think for people who see themselves as sort of serious home musicians or are, you know, really into their gear, I think they have that there is a little bit more flexibility on pricing, and really that you know, I've bought Focusrite products in the past myself. They do make some very high quality products, and in part that means they've been a bit of a victim of their own success because the replacement levels aren't quite as frequent as some other retailers. But that does give them a degree of pricing power and also brand quality and also loyalty, because people you know, in this market like to work with good quality hardware and maybe less prone to compromising there. So, yeah, I think I'd probably disagree on that point.
I suppose as well, you can say, you know, given the manufacturing, the equipment accounts for most of the cost of sales, but at the same time, they do seem to have still a decent return on capital employed, which also sort of suggests that, you know, what you've just been saying, that people do want to pay up for some of these things.
For sure. What Julian's saying there, I mean, you can find cheaper Chinese-made versions for anything. And if price point is the ultimate decider, then yes, there is that, you know, they do come up against some challenges there. But in the main, I think they've got a defendable product.
The other side of the business, the one that did particularly well in these results, albeit it's a much smaller part of the business, or quite a bit smaller, is the live music side of things. And that really benefited from, you know, it seems strange to say this now, the return of live music. So it feels like that's been going on for a while. But, you know, these are full year results and you can see the real uplift there. Is that a potential, you know, growth driver in the future, the continued expansion of, you know, all these live events and festivals? You know, there seems to be 1,001 festivals everywhere nowadays. Or is that just creating tough comparatives in that part of the business now for next year?
Yeah, I would say yes to growth, but yeah, the caveat you point out there will be very much on the minds of investors. So the question has to really be if the live music division, where they've seen very strong growth in the last couple of years, and this is where Focusrite supplies things like preamps, consoles, and the like. The question has to be if that's just going to result in a sort of repeat of what we've seen in the home studio division, whereby big orders, you know, kind of end up petering out because there's not quite the backlog to fulfill or demand to fulfill next year or in 2 years' time. But I do think there is growth here, in part because I think they've given themselves lots of markets to go after. I mean, just to take one example, it's small, but if you go on their website, you can see that they, you know, one of their customer bases here is revival churches. It sounds quite a different market to, you know, sort of garage bands.
Is that the trendy vicar end of
it? Yeah. I mean, there's trendy, and then there's all, you know, there's also sort of, you know, blockbuster stadium churches.
Okay.
But here, you know, the professional level audio systems are a big part of, I suppose, congregations' expectations of religious services. So there are actually lots of end markets here. It's not just a case of live music or home studio. They know where their potential growth markets are, and I think there is possibly more opportunity in this live market than the shares currently are implying there is value in.
Do they, I mean, they do derive a decent chunk of revenue from the US as well, where, just to stick on the church's point, those kind of, you know, big mega churches and things are a big business. So I don't know if those two things overlap much.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, another potential, I suppose. We've spoken about the various end markets, and they have made quite a few acquisitions in the past few years. Seems to be a few over the past 12 months as well. I think it did take them a few years when they listed about a decade ago. You know, they weren't really very acquisitive at the beginning. Should we kind of see them as a buy and build kind of strategy, as we've spoken about a few times on the podcast over recent months? Is that the kind of business they are now, or is that just a natural part of any business getting bigger and looking to expand?
Yeah, they are in part that. And I think, to their credit, they have done this quite well, so acquiring smaller businesses. I mean, the first point to say is their in-house product development pipeline is strong. I think they released, you know, 30-odd products in the last financial year. So they are able to update their suite of products, and for some of their customers, buying the latest version is an important thing to have. At the same time, they are always looking to sort of diversify, in a sense, within the broader music software and hardware sector. So things like software development kind of makes sense from an M&A perspective, because there is a trade-off here. A software developer will bring its own set of skills that they might not have in-house, but Focusrite is a well-established name in the recording and live music world, and it has, you know, fantastic distribution channels. So a company like, they bought a software developer called Sonox in the last financial year. It makes sense for them to join a division like Focusrite rather than go it alone. Because if you're a small software development team, what you want to focus on is doing software development, not all the, you know, the company building necessarily that comes with getting bigger. And that, for example, looks to have been really successful. So this division, Sonox, which sells kind of software plugins for home studio recording, made a profit contribution of nearly £1 million in the year, and it was bought for £7.2 million. So you know, that this buy and build strategy can work if done at sensible prices. And they seem to have a handle on what a sensible price and the growth that can come with it in their distribution network can be.
And what about the valuation itself then? Because, you know, the shares are back, you know, where they were, you know, not even kind of pre-pandemic levels, a little bit below that now in some ways, having fallen so far from the peak. You know, in the middle of the pandemic, there was an undersupply of, you know, various things, for, as we know all about supply chains during that time, and certainly for products that are in demand. That then shifted to, you know, overstocking as demand withered away and they'd built up too much. That seems to have been worked through now. But yeah, how does all this play into whether the business looks like good value now or otherwise?
Yeah, maybe three things to say here. The first is, I mean, obviously, looking at the stock price chart, it's not a pretty sight. We're 74% off the peak and back to a level that the shares first reached in 2018. So clearly, Focusrite is not the growth stock it was back then. So we shouldn't be expecting it to trade on the same sort of earnings multiple as either the pre-pandemic days or during the pandemic. And you know, investors always need to remember that that is one of the two really big ingredients for share prices. You know, here's the big but: it is generating about twice the level of operating profit as it was back then in 2018. The brand has had five more years and a pandemic in which to build goodwill and broaden its customer base. And so in some aspects, it is a stronger business, even though the margins and sales are obviously under pressure. So on balance, 12 times forward earnings looks quite cheap, I think, given their asset base management, you know, brand name, reputation of quality products. They don't have really much debt on the balance sheet. The flip side to that as well is that forecasts are going nowhere. And so it's hard to see from a sales perspective where growth is going to come from. But they are a very cash generative business, and that gives them options. So, you know, one option perhaps would be to look at the dividend. They raised it 10% this year, and it's still to a fairly negligible level, but the dividend is covered nearly five times by earnings. So one way perhaps to you know, sort of juice returns is to maybe revise the dividend policy. They would probably say they have got lots of other attractive investment opportunities to look at as well. But, you know, they need a catalyst, clearly, but there is definitely a quality business buried under this, you know, slightly sorry stock price chart here. I think for long-term holders who've stayed with the business, they would, you know, I think there are not many reasons to doubt that they could have another good 10 years ahead of them once they've, you know, they sort of emerged from these tricky comparators, and there's a bit more of a growth story to hang the hat on.
Yeah, there's certainly, you know, there is those aspects of a quality business there. You know, the management seems fairly well aligned and well respected as well. Phil Dudridge, the founder and chair, I think, you know, was a roadie with Led Zeppelin in the 70s to begin with. So very much something that someone who's built a passion project into a successful business there.
There's a few stories behind that stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, he could have some colourful tales far away
involving an octopus, if I seem to remember.
Involving an octopus?
Yes.
Wow.
But anyway, that's a story for another time.
Well, yeah, that's an entirely separate podcast. Well, yeah, Focusrite, you know, the momentum isn't there at the moment, clearly, but we're going to turn now to a business which does have both good operating momentum and good share price momentum, and that is XPS Pensions. Julian, you covered these figures for us. You've written about them, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, separately in the magazine and online as well. First of all, you know, how do the results look? And say a little bit more about what the business does, because, you know, it's a pensions consultancy, and that covers all manner of things nowadays, you know, advising pension funds and pension schemes.
So, yeah, the company is essentially an advisor, a fee-charging advisor to pension funds who need all sorts of advice with how to manage the funds, how to comply with regulations, how to administer the funds. So they essentially have two divisions, one which is a sort of administrator that sends out you know, the annual prospectus every year or keeps people's details up to date. And the other side of it is an actuarial advice business, which is the more high value part of XPS, which advises pension funds on tricky things like transferring liabilities over to the insurance industry and, you know, other things to do with complying with legislation and things like that. So it's a very specialized business, and the results showed that it's one that's growing exponential rates. So the revenue growth was 19% and in the last set of results, and they're working off margins which are close to 50%, which is extraordinary really for a business which doesn't sound particularly interesting from the outside. But the main feature that they have, which I think is quite important and a key differentiator with sort of more commoditized management consulting type businesses, is that not everyone can do it. So essentially they have to employ quite highly skilled actuaries in order to give formal advice. The risks are very high if they get it wrong. So, they have to carry everything high. Liability insurance is obviously quite high for them. But it is a business that's growing very quickly. And, there is a fundamental reason for that is the maturity of a lot of defined benefit pension schemes. Last autumn, the Conservative government managed to solve the pension deficit problem in corporate Britain almost overnight. And the resulting high interest rates means that many DB schemes are in profit or in surplus now. And that has encouraged them to offload the liabilities onto insurance companies, life insurers, at a very good rate. And XPS advises on this process and helps to do all the paperwork, which is extensive. And it means that there are fundamental drivers behind the business, and they're meeting a lot of increased demand for that. It's not one that would ever be on anyone's radar, I don't think. But it has had a lot of, the share price has had a lot of momentum over the last 6 to 8 months. And, it's up almost, I think, 60% on the year. So, you could say it's one of the best performing shares on the market at the moment. So it is a strange, quirky business that makes a virtue out of, in a sense, doing something that other people would find either complex or boring.
Yeah.
In any other context.
Yeah. Which can often be, as it's the case here, a route to success. The two sides of the business, there are various different things it does, and as you boil it down to, really the actuarial side versus the administration side, that the former is much higher margin and has been growing certainly in the past 6 months at a faster rate, which is obviously good for the company's profitability. Can we expect that to continue, or how does the balance between the two of them play out perhaps as well?
Well, the advantage they have is that they've got a pricing power advantage, because there are not many companies outside perhaps the very big four consultancies that offer this kind of advice. And so their contracts are quite solid with inflation linked uplifts and things like that. So they don't lose, they've not lost anything out of there being a rising cost. So the admin business is important for the pensions business, because it often leads to clients coming back to XPS and saying, can we have the advice to move our funds? And they have a lot of blue chip clients in it. So they, they've got John Lewis pension fund in there, BT is in the admin side. For them, it's, although it's not as profitable, it is actually quite a good showcase for them, kind of window, dress window for the rest of the business. They often get clients who come in on an admin side and they can pass them through to higher value actuarial advice. So it's quite a good split from that, or they work together quite well. Your point about growth is interesting. The business will keep growing as long as the market in pensions transfers continues to grow. And the thinking on that is that there's at least two more years of solid growth in it before you reach a limit where schemes can no longer be easily transferred, insurers don't have the capital to take on the liability. So it's, I think from the current share price levels, they're hovering around 24 times earnings. It's not a cheap business by any means, but when you break down the components, the quality of the earnings growth is really quite apparent when you look at the fact that it's not affected by inflation. Its only real constraint is the capacity to take on new work. It generates a lot of operational gearing, and you can almost say it's worth the premium that they generate.
I suppose just to go back to Charlie Munger mentioned at the top, that was one of the lessons he kind of gave to Berkshire, wasn't it? It was really, move them away from a simply buying cheap companies to buying good companies, even if they were trading at a premium kind of price level. I'm not saying you'd buy XPS pensions, but you know, some of those high valuations are worth bearing in mind in that context, I think.
Well, it's true. It's really quite true, yes. I mean, and if you compare them to like a standard consulting company, they've all had to do discounts this year just to get business in through the door. And yeah, it shows you that it's not a commoditized, you know, service that has no value.
Mm. And I think even, you know, certainly the bulk annuities, the risk transfer side that you've talked about is going to keep going for a while. But there are other parts of the gravy train, if you want to call it that, as well, aren't there? Even if they're administrative based, you know, there's things like the DB funding code coming in next year, which I think they and other pension specialists anticipate getting a lot of business from, and you know, various court rulings as well, if you can get down into the weeds really with some of those. But those kind of things really create a continued pipeline of business, because schemes want to know what the latest situation is, and a lot of the times that situation is changing.
Well, I mean, it changes all the time. I mean, pensions legislation is a movable feast, and nobody knows what it will look like in 5 years' time or what the impact will be. And I mean, that just creates a demand for accurate advice. So, yeah, I definitely think that beyond the EB transfer market, there are other drivers in it. And I mean, if they can continue. If they can continue hiring enough people in order to take on the billable, in order to be able to charge billable hours, then I don't think they'll have any trouble generating growth.
Yeah. The final point on that, I just wanted to touch on hiring and staff, because we have seen with some of the other consultancies, you know, this situation where you hire a lot of people and then you end up, having hired too many, which might not be the case here given the growth drivers we've spoken about. But also, you know, those staff costs do go up, and with a successful business, you know, wage demands, certainly in the current climate as well, are going to increase. You know, is that something to keep an eye on, or is that something they're managing well enough, it seems?
Well, I think it seems to be, they don't seem to have a huge amount of cost inflation in the business, but the beauty of their contracts is that whatever does come through as higher cost, they can charge and pass on to the customers. So I don't think that will be a particular threat to their profitability. Obviously, trying to find enough skilled people is a potential problem in the long run. There we might start seeing them becoming more acquisitive. I mean, they have bought businesses over the last few years. At least they made at least five different transactions, and around 40 million of capital has gone into buying in talent effectively. It's not a case, I don't think, that they'll struggle. You know, even if you can't hire a fully fledged actuary, what they tend to do is get in the graduates, you know, at a graduate level. And then that allows people further up the chain to, you know, pass on work to them, and then they can take on more higher billing work. You know, there is a benign cycle where you can create capacity without necessarily creating expense.
Indeed.
But yeah, so you know, it's an interesting business. I mean, they're going to deleverage as well. They've sold NPT recently, one of their segments, but they'll use that to deleverage. The money from that was about 35 million in cash up front. I think that puts them in a very strong position, as far as I can tell. I mean, it's a really solid business.
Indeed. We are now going to turn to our final segment of the show. That is our cover story this week, which is on energy security. James, the author, is here with us. Now, when you say energy security in the past couple of years, I think people are probably quite conscious of some of the things that involved, and certainly some of the context too. But can you talk us through, to begin with, just your thinking behind the piece? What drove you to write it?
Oh, I had to, I think. That's for the
well, you suggested that I commissioned you. At that point, you had to write it. But yeah, before that.
No, really, what sort of drove me to write the piece was, you talk about some very emotive issues. You've got, you know, the energy transition and climate change, which is pretty terrifying, admittedly. And you also have issues of geopolitics and energy security. And you can find all manner of commentary on these things. I can't claim to be an expert on geopolitics or on climate science, but it's interesting to really to think about it in the thought process of an investor, which really comes down to you know, risks, rewards, probabilities of risk, probabilities of failure. I've tried to outline some of the cases, you know, that people have probably read before, but in a way that is maybe a little less emotive and maybe a bit more cynical.
And there's certainly some new thinking in there as well. I think, you know, don't want to do yourself down, which we'll come to as well on the company side of things later on. But to start with, why don't we talk about, you know, last year, obviously, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the spike in energy prices we saw after that, that really kind of put, for many European countries, you know, the need for pragmatism when it comes to energy production and energy security back on the agenda. What are kind of the lessons we can learn from that period? Is it that pragmatism will be required at times or throughout, or what did you take from that?
Well, I think one of the things is actually when you have a serious event and your planning maybe hasn't been circumspect, that actually it can be damaging to your goals of dealing with climate change as well. For example, you know, Germany's move away from nuclear has left in a situation where the decision to burn more coal because it became ridiculously dependent on Russian gas. That's not a good place to be in. The UK, we greatly reduced our gas storage capacity, which means that even a country with vast renewable potential like the UK, just to do with the way the wholesale price market operates, people who, you know, people like me who are on a green energy ended up paying more for our electricity because of the dynamics of the wholesale market, as well as obviously you need a baseline for when the wind doesn't blow. So it's just this level of planning wasn't there, and it has an impact on companies, had an impact on consumers. You know, it obviously the spike in inflation had a huge impact on the government. It's a very large part of the reason that we had problems with government bond yields, and you know, obviously compounded by the so-called mini budget last year, but it's it has knock-on effect. And really, I think that's kind of the point of the whole piece, is a bit more second order thinking, which is the way investors do think.
Let's talk about the US and China in this regard. You know, the two superpowers, if you want to use a perhaps slightly dated phrase now, but you know, their impact on the concept of energy security and, you know, some of the companies we can get to again in a minute. Why don't we start with the US and some of the decisions they've made, and then we can maybe come on to China and its, you know, the things we hear a lot about nowadays about its control of various rare earths and the production of, you know, various things which go into producing renewables and renewable energy that we all use. It's got a lot of those markets sewn up already.
Well, they're superpowers and they're super polluters. So they're both the top two polluters in the world. And China's something like 29% of global carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels, which is enormous. And really, while the US, you know, has gained plaudits for the Inflation Reduction Act, which has some very good objectives, America did have a very energy dominant position. I mean, it is a net exporter now of energy, but its supply chains of energy have possibly been disrupted by maybe trying to move too quickly in a way. That's not to do down the importance of investment, but actually, you know, you need to be quite so hostile towards their domestic oil and gas industry at the same time as they were doing that, because US gas is actually one of the reasons why America's fossil fuels, well, net emissions have actually fallen, even though they haven't been doing that much to lessen their consumption. It's a good transitional fuel, particularly if you're sitting on that resource as they are. And again, with when there comes disconnects in supply chains, you know, they've had to go and import and go begging the Saudis and the Venezuelans for oil. And so even from a climate perspective, you know, you've got, there's very different levels of cleanliness with fuel that goes into refinery process as well. So in a way, you know, it's kind of, again, it just coming back to this point of second order thinking, what's the impact? You know, it's your security. Does it detract from climate goals in the short term if you're sort of getting energy from sources which are extracted in a less green way, are refinable in a less green way, and ultimately encourage and embolden regimes which care about these things far less than you do?
And on the China side of things, you know, I mean, obviously that's the way the world has worked for many decades. You know, China produces a lot of what the rest of us consume, but that side of things, when you think about energy security, is something that politicians are more conscious of now, in part because of the, you know, worsening relations with China until perhaps, you know, last couple of months, but also because, you know, China is really making a name for itself in these new energy areas as well?
China is a real sort of dichotomy. On the one hand, it's obviously a global industrial powerhouse, still very much powered by coal. It keeps emitting fossil fuels because it keeps needing more energy, but it is putting more and more of that energy is coming on to its credit through nuclear renewables, a global leader really in electrolysis for hydrogen production, for example. But China has, from the security perspective, there's a bit of a risk to the West, the fact that China has really stolen a march on sort of the supply chains and the processing of rare earths that are necessary for a lot of the energy transition, but also the fact that we're depending very much on China to manufacture some of the harder sort of infrastructure for our own energy transition, which in the short term is increasing demand for those coal burning factories. So again, it does beg the question, would we be better off with a slightly, it's a question, I'm not offering a definitive answer to annoy environmentalists here, but it's worth having that thought process of what are the risks here in the short term? Is it helping you achieve those objectives, and are you compromising some security, creating dependence, and moving away from fossil fuels too quickly in the meanwhile?
Mm. Another interesting aspect of the piece is the use of the Black Litterman model to look at companies and their valuations and what the market is saying about them versus what traditional pricing models might be saying. Can you say a little bit more? Or can you encapsulate this very complicated modelling, perhaps?
Well, Black Litterman really is not to do directly with client, but it is about opinion. I mean, when I was looking at, how should an investor react to this? I mean, the typical conclusion you might think to a feature like this is, here's a list of companies that will benefit from this, and this. Well, actually, the market and most investors will probably be able to work out for themselves. If you think oil prices are going to be elevated, then don't sell Shell straight away. If you think defense security is an issue, then you go into security firms. You think that we want copper's going to be important by Antofagasta. People already think that, but everyone else in the market will think that. But really, it's an idea of weighing up how opinions in the market are expressed, relative to traditional capital asset pricing model risk. But Black Litterman really is a way of assessing your own opinions and measuring it against the risk reward in the market. So it's kind of a way of self-monitoring rather than anything that's particularly to do with energy itself.
Mm. But nonetheless, an interesting aspect of the piece, I think, looking at that. And it might be something we explore in more detail in future as well. That does bring us to the end of today's show, though. As I say, that is our cover feature this week in print and online, so do check that out. Thank you to James for discussing that. Thank you to Alex and to Julian as well. And thank you to Maddie Apthorpe, our producer. We will be back next time with another Companies and Market Show.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.